Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello and welcome to Versus History. I'm Dr. Elliot L. Watson, and with me, as always, are co-editors of Versus History, Patrick O'Shaughnessy and Connell Smith. We are coming today to you from the rooftop of Connell Smith's house, social distancing in Bahrain. How are you guys?
Very good, thank you. Enjoying the bird song in the background from a tree. Feeling very relaxed, and it's nice to have to be forced to be more than 2 meters away.
Patrick, I'm here nonetheless. I tell you what, it's lovely. I feel like I'm in LA or like, you know, on the Great Lakes, just staring out amongst a beautiful view, gentlemen. It's lovely.
On the Great Lakes?
Well, yeah, and there's not so much palm trees on the Great Lakes, more sort of, you know, tepid waves and whatnot, but it's lovely to be here, gentlemen. It does feel a bit LA-ish, doesn't it?
It is. Yeah, it does with the palm trees.
Climate-wise, it definitely does. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we have decided today to come to you with an offering in these times of coronavirus that can perhaps or will perhaps take your mind off the coronavirus for maybe 30 minutes, but also something that has evolved out of our self-isolation. And today we're going to be talking about Netflix.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for many people at the moment, Netflix is, well, I was reading that the quality that you're allowed to stream it in Europe has been reduced because of the bandwidth that's being taken up as people self-isolate, as people social distance, I guess. More time at home, more time on the sofa.
Right.
And when you've got a treasure trove of historical documentaries, of films, of that merely a click away. It's dominating the internet traffic, isn't it? So it seems relevant for us to talk about.
Netflix is the power player in home entertainment, right? Up there with Amazon Prime Video. I'm sure many people have an Amazon Prime account. I'm sure many people have a Netflix account as well. I'm sure most people have got one or the other, if not both.
Yeah, but we're not just talking about Netflix because we all have been using it, perhaps, during this time of isolation, but also because of its perhaps projected historical significance. Pat?
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, if you go to your Netflix home screen, gentlemen and listeners, no doubt you'll have seen the array of films and sort of the Netflix own home brand content, which is exceptionally popular. There's also, to quote Connell, there's a treasure trove of historical content there. Documentaries, films, dramatizations.
Docudramas.
Dramamentaries, yeah. I prefer.
And I would hasten a bet, far more people have watched some accessed historical content via the Netflix medium over the last 12 months than have gone out and sort of bought a book, history book, or read a history magazine. So
I'd imagine. So one of the things we're going to talk about is perhaps how Netflix and these kinds of platforms are going to shape the way that we receive our history, but also maybe even shape the history itself. And I know, Patrick, later you're going to talk about one particular documentary that has had a significant impact on the way that history has been interpreted on one specific event.
Right. You could argue has had the most impact, even though it's probably the most recent, on how history is viewed, and not even how it's viewed, the history itself. So we'll get to that in a hot minute.
Okay. Shall I just give a very, very rapid overview of Netflix as a service?
Please do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is very, very basic. In 1997, it starts with two chaps, Reed Hastings and Mark Randolph. I think Mark Randolph used to work for Hastings or vice versa. And they decided that they would attempt to provide a service supplying films to the public in the same way that Amazon supplies the public with their products online, so that you never actually have to leave your house. And so initially they thought that they could provide DVDs, rentals, as well as sales. At the time, Blockbuster was the dominant force in home entertainment. You had to go to a bricks and mortar shop and you had to go in and rent a video or a DVD. And they believed that an online service where you would have the films delivered directly to your door, that would actually be something that people would pay for. Eventually, soon.
I was as well. Yeah. I did that at $5.99, two DVDs at a time, I think. I remember them arriving.
Is that
in the
right?
Post.
I've never actually used it. I never actually used
I'm
it to get DVDs.
I'm trying to think
DVD.
When that was. Probably 2010?
Yeah, well, it was a clumsy service. It seemed really, really convenient at the time, but looking back on it in retrospect, it was really, really, really clumsy.
Well, they still have 3 million subscribers to their DVD-only distribution service in the United States. Yeah, they do. So they started this service, and they caught the beginning of the DVD home entertainment player trend, and so that helped to boost their sales. And then Blockbuster, the bricks and mortar Blockbuster, went out of business. Ironically, they were offered, Netflix offered Blockbuster the Netflix brand and their infrastructure for $50 million back in something like 2000, and Blockbuster turned it down. Now, of course, for those of you who are too young to know Blockbuster, they obviously went well out of business, and Netflix have gone on from strength to strength. Now, Netflix, by bandwidth, I believe, is the single biggest user in the world currently in terms of the amount of bandwidth that
people
use.
It's actually contributing to global warming, so they think. So in many people are consuming Netflix data, and they've currently had to reduce the bandwidth to Europe by about 20 or 25%, but so many people are accessing the Netflix online streaming medium. To power that and to make that happen and facilitate it, it's consuming so much more energy. So not only is it having an impact on history, it's having an impact on dreaded geography as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to you.
Well, they currently have over 150 million subscribers. I know I pay, I think, $9.99. Is that what it is, a month?
Yeah.
And so it's $7.99. Oh, you get different levels of subscription. I think ours it was £7.99.
Right. Ah, well, maybe $9.99. And I think I have five different people that can access mine, me and my family. So this really is a behemoth in entertainment. And the reason we've really decided to talk about this is because we've been sitting at home when we aren't working, and we've been consuming the products of Netflix, and we imagine that people all over the world are doing likewise. And we figured, because we've watched quite a few historical documentaries or historical films on Netflix, we may as well talk about this and any impact potentially that this new medium of communicating history might have on history itself.
So, think so.
Where should we start?
So. I've got a place to start if
go
you
on,
would like, gentlemen.
Where are you
going
to go?
Yeah. It's one of Netflix's own productions. Who killed Malcolm X?
Right.
We've talked about Malcolm X before, sort of way back in like 2018. Say way back, but a little while ago anyway. Netflix very, very recently, this year in fact, 2020, have released, I think it's 6-part documentary, Who Killed Malcolm X?
And have you watched that?
I've watched it twice. It's that good. Obviously, I'm a Malcolm X aficionado. I've pretty much read every book on Malcolm, be it Marable Manning's excellent biography, Malcolm X's autobiography. I've read all sorts of articles looking at him from an Islamic perspective, a black militant perspective, civil rights perspective.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I love Malcolm X, and I thought it was a great documentary. Netflix is a great service.
So
well,
how does the Netflix documentary...
This is a great documentary.
How does the next Netflix documentary stand? As in, what's it trying to do? Is it trying to take that sort of biographical journey? Can you just give us a sense of the
I mean,
the
these
program?
Things, we were talking just before we came on air, folks, about how these documentaries or books or historical perspectives that look solely at who killed someone, you know, they have their limitations. This, no less, it's a gentleman called Abdul Rahman Muhammad, who's from Washington. He's a Muslim, converted to Islam in the 1980s. But similar to me, I suppose he's got a great interest in Malcolm X. So what this book, or sorry, this documentary does, or this 6-part documentary, it tells the life of Malcolm, really focusing on his time in the Nation of Islam. It also talks extensively about the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, which lots of textbooks and lots of books don't do. They just cut him and them out of the story.
Because
and it tells
often,
the story of him afterwards.
That's right. It starts from his separation from the Nation of Islam, and then a look at what he did independent of them, correct? So this goes back a little bit, right?
It certainly does, and it the whole documentary, the premise of it, is built on the book that I'm holding now. It's the biography by the now deceased RIP, Manning Marable, Professor Manning Marable, who released, I think, back in 2012 or 2014. In this book, it upset a lot of people. It made a lot of people very happy, because lots of people like to read about Malcolm X, but it also upset a lot of people, because it showed Malcolm from a multitude of perspectives, the Islamic perspective, focusing on the last year of his life, mainly between 64 and 65, when he was more in the sort of orthodox Islamic camp, and also in the secular political world, with the Organization of Afro-American Unity. But it also showed Malcolm, sort of guts, glory and all. It showed the perspective of him in the Nation of Islam, and focused extensively on the formative processes he went through in that organisation under the tutelage of Elijah Muhammad, which, I mean, we're all history teachers. I don't talk about history teaching too much. That's not why we're here. But most textbooks or most books, when they talk about Malcolm, Elijah Muhammad gets a fleeting mention. But no, this doesn't take it that way. It shows about the sort of father-son relationship they developed, how Malcolm interacted within this. And it also really goes into detail and doesn't reduce to monocausality the reasons for him leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the main thrust of it, and I know Professor Kehinde Andrews in his recent blog post criticised the documentary slightly for saying it's sort of fetish too much at the whodunit perspective.
Yeah.
But ultimately, given this is quite recent history, and some of the accused who have now been released are still alive,
uh-huh.
I didn't find it all that bad. There's a gentleman out there, we'll come on to him in a second, he's now called Khalil Islam. It's largely accepted he was wrongly convicted of the murder. And the gentleman who is hosting this documentary goes and speaks to him. As I said, his name is Abdulrahman Muhammad. And they're talking about, you know, trying to get him an exoneration, a pardon. Mm. So whilst this is sort of celebrating history, showcasing history, giving a platform to history, unlike many other books, this is actually going to potentially change history. So I know the detective department, think of New York or the police department, looking at maybe reopening the investigation into this.
So what you're saying is that this historical documentary has had a real-world impact and therefore has the potential to actually amend or append the history of Malcolm X.
Yeah, it certainly did, and it certainly potentially could do.
Yeah.
There was a lot of positive things about it. I'm not saying it was perfect, because nothing's perfect, but if you'll just allow me just to rattle on, jump in when I'm getting boring or repeating myself.
I'll jump in now then.
Yeah. there was a number of positive features, I think, about this documentary, which I really liked. Now, presentism in history, folks, is one of my sort of pet hates, along with having a sort of teleological approach.
Can you just explain what that is?
Yeah, it's when, ultimately, history is history. Okay, it happened in a certain time, in a context, in a certain place, with certain cultural values and norms. It's almost discrete from us now. So when we look back at history from the present, quite often we can bring baggage with us, folks. Like, we can bring our own cultural perceptions and norms with us, and we can superimpose them onto the past. Now, I'll give you an example. Like, if you read some history magazines, quite often, to make the substantive disciplinary, you know, or the raw historical knowledge more appealing or bite-sized, quite often what people will do is they'll sort of try and sort of fudge it down. So you might see like a Facebook post from Elizabeth I. Well, that's almost presentism, because in our current modern-day context, yes, we're used to abbreviating, making off-the-mark comments, so on and so forth. But Elizabeth I would never, ever, ever have done that, because she was hellishly aware that every seemingly private comment was actually public, because it would be reported on by a network of spies, ladies in waiting. So that would never have happened.
So history, are we saying that history is under threat by presentism? And ever more so because of the rise.
You just have to guard, like many other things, you just have to guard against it, as we're all aware. Now, I think this documentary went to great pains to try and avoid it. Now, one of the criticisms, if you want to learn all about Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam, you can go back to our other podcast, or you can read about him, you know, that's fine. But what I want to clarify here is, quite often in our modern day context, the presentism where we fetish the good speaker,
mm-hmm.
okay, which is definitely a quality we attribute to Malcolm X. He was a phenomenal speaker, and that's acknowledged in the documentary. Now, the similar way we build Malcolm up, we often do down Elijah Muhammad. We look at Elijah Muhammad and his sort of jittery, broken Southern drawl,
mm-hmm.
and we think, how on earth could this guy have led this organisation when he's almost incomprehensible, babbling on about religious teachings, when this Malcolm X is out there making fiery speeches in Harlem and on Broadway?
Well, yeah.
This is presentism, folks. Elijah Muhammad never ever sought to communicate with anything or anyone beyond the Black American community.
Uh-huh.
Now, in the tones in which he referenced quite often the Old Testament, which maybe in our modern day world, disassociated from the Black American experience, maybe, that really has very limited traction. But Elijah Muhammad was talking in tones and with words and using parables that the Black American community would understand. As we know, having studied slavery, stories of the Old Testament were really, really ingrained into the Christian Black American tradition.
So does this documentary correct that?
What it does is it speaks to various members of the old Nation of Islam, and they say in no uncertain terms that this man was the closest thing to God on earth. Mm. And when he spoke, we listened. What he told us to do, we did. And in fact, it actually goes to correct it, because there was a female former member of the Nation of Islam on there, and she talks about how the fact he was small in stature, he wore a bow tie, he was calm, he never raised his voice, that actually boosted his appeal. Mm. She says he was like the sort of they were like the royal family, Elijah Muhammad's folks. So these very things that we fetish now, the sort of, you know, off the mark anecdotes, being able to sort of wax lyrical, being a good speaker, postulating, making arm movements, these are things that Elijah Muhammad didn't do. So we might think in our current context, how on earth could this guy have had such an appeal? How could he have set up the biggest black American organization of all time? But he did.
Is this not perhaps a function or a consequence of the attraction of young men and women to Malcolm X? At university, one of the first posters that you would see on walls of the university students would be a poster of Malcolm X or a quotation by Malcolm X. And is that not just a function of age? And so the older we get, and the older perhaps the information that we consume changes, and therefore we tend towards trying to find a greater degree of age-appropriate history or something like that?
There's also domain specificity at play here. Mm. When we look at the Malcolm X speeches, like the ballot and the bullet, they're the ones with no religious references phrased in them, by and large.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
And they tend to be after, like the one from the Oxford Union in 64, I think it was, or early 65. We tend to look at, from our secular political standpoint, the speeches he made when he either had left the nation,
uh-huh,
or when he was talking in or about his organisation of Afro-American Unity, his non-religious perspective.
Yeah.
When you look at Malcolm's speeches in the Nation of Islam, everything that he says is either prefixed or suffixed with the Honourable Elijah Muhammad teaches us.
Yeah, yeah.
And his political content is definitely there, and that's one of the reasons he ultimately left. He wanted to become political. He was operating ultra vires with it in terms of that the Nation of Islam's sort of really dogmatic religious code. So what I will say is, we often, with spectacles of presentism, when we're looking at what Malcolm X has said, done or did, we often focus on the bits that appeal to us or work for us in what we're trying to do, which is that secular or political.
I was just thinking, as you were talking about that as well, I guess, do you think that's also partly the media culture that we're in, as in somebody who's very charismatic, who's very visual?
Mm.
We grow up where you have personality visually in politicians, etc. Whereas you go back to the early 60s, late 50s, you know, television wasn't everywhere in quite the same way.
Yeah.
There's not that kind of very
much so
present personality.
Yeah, I think in America, I think Baudrillard, the French philosopher, called it the Colgate smile. And in order to get ahead in politics in the United States, particularly in the United States in the 70s and the 80s, you had to have a Colgate smile, which is, when we talk about the Kennedy-Nixon debates, people who listened on the radio thought Nixon had won. People who saw Kennedy speaking thought that he had won. So perhaps it all feeds in. But if that's the one documentary that has obviously had a profound impact on you, but also on...
I've got one more thing, if that's all right, gentlemen, because I think it's important when students are learning, or anyone's learning about Malcolm X. The reason for his leaving the tutelage of the Honourable Elijah Muhammad, as he was called by his followers and the Nation of Islam, is often just sort of distilled down to this monocausal. Elijah Muhammad was having relationships with lots of his young secretaries. Malcolm didn't like it because he was highly religious, so therefore left. Mm. Well, that was definitely one strand. But let's just make it very, very clear. Malcolm didn't cite that at the time as being a reason for him leaving. So if we root ourselves in the primary sources of the time, Malcolm knew about this, but so did every other member of the Nation of Islam.
Mm.
This was no secret. And accusations from without, Eric Lincoln made it very clear in his doctoral thesis way back in the late 50s or 60s, the Nation of Islam couldn't give a damn about any external critique. They're not interested in that. If you talk to members of the Nation of Islam, they're not looking for celebration or acknowledgement from anyone outside of the community.
Mm.
They are intra-focused. They're focused on each other. So if anything, the Honourable Elijah Muhammad claiming that he had divine permission to take more wives only lent to this religious mystique that he had. He was fully entitled to do it because, as Elijah Muhammad said, he'd been divinely inspired or ordained to do that. Mm. So when we look from outside, sort of from removed from the time, yeah, outside of the organization, we think this must be a prima facie reason for Malcolm leaving. It played a part, but there were actually far bigger reasons, which I've never seen quoted in textbooks. So I just want to give you one of them, because I think it's important. It's really Malcolm X's, the fact he had a really poor relationship with the upper echelons, like John Ali of the Nation of Islam. He had a really poor relationship with Elijah Muhammad's children, apart from maybe Wallace Muhammad, or Warif, as he would come to be called after his father's death, right? But ultimately, it wasn't really the marriage issue that pushed him out. It was Malcolm was looking to become more political and to bring the nation with him. Elijah Muhammad had no interest in politics, and nor did the Nation of Islam by and large. As I said, they were intra-focused, and I think the documentary corrects that.
Good.
So yeah, I think that's really my point. And the final thing I will say is, when it comes to changing history, I've never really seen a documentary, chat, I don't know if you have, or read a book, which has actually changed history in and of the moment of history. But the potential exoneration of one of the three convicted murderers, if he were to get a pardon, that would really change the historical record and discourse forevermore. And that probably only came about because of this documentary. It opened up so much interest in it and has really, really put it in the forefront of public consciousness. I was very impressed.
I was going to say, I guess that's an interesting kind of overlap, really, with investigative journalism. As in, we can look at these sorts of documentaries or whatever we're calling them as historical investigations, right? The way that they phrase the title of that, Who Killed Malcolm X, is it's investigative. And I guess investigative journalists, God, I'm trying to say it 10 times in 10 seconds, yeah, they have made differences to pardons, exonerations, incriminating people. And I guess we're starting to see perhaps the transition of that away from journalists employed by newspapers, etc., into, well, actually,
documentary journalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think we have seen the rise of particular, and Netflix has been at the forefront of these kinds of revising or the revision of certain events that have occurred in the past with a different eye. I think Making a Murderer was a landmark documentary that came out about 5 years ago, which it was a criminal investigation. We're not necessarily talking about historical, but it forced an opening of the eyes of many people, and it focused them on perhaps the way that we perceive our own reality or the justice system or in what we're talking about in terms of history, the significance of its impact on history. Now, Connell, since you've been doing nothing over the last...
3 hours.
No, not now. Over the last 6 weeks, just with your feet up watching Netflix.
Which is certainly not true.
what have you seen on Netflix? What do you think is worthy of discussion?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a number of things out there. Not that many that I've watched in the last 6 weeks. No, I was just thinking in terms of changing perceptions, probably actually going back maybe 6 months ago, I was watching When They See Us about the Central Park Five.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And kind of, which is again a miscarriage of justice and kind of exploring that. But seeing how that took kind of social media by storm, I guess is changing the perceptions.
Now, the Central, just to insert, this was the Central Park Five were convicted of the rape and murder of a young lady. And do you, it was in the news about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when Donald Trump, he took out a full-page advert in the New York Times, I think it was, basically saying we should reinstate the death penalty for these guys. So it still has common currency now, but what you're saying is that it has an impact today.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm just expanding the discussion into the current and how it tractions on social media. I think the other side of Netflix that actually I probably love more than those sorts of series is just how you find some excellent old school documentaries on there that I
example
kind
of, so I was flicking through She Wolves by Helen Castor about medieval women who changed the past. So we did a podcast, I don't know, towards the end of last year, I think, on Eleanor of Aquitaine. On Matilda, and then we did another one previously. So like there's an episode on both of those that's out there. But that I was watching World War II and Greatest Events of World War II in colour.
Yeah.
Basically, just I find it so beneficial to kind of indulge myself through seeing with stuff like World War II the actual images, the pictures, comparing it kind of where Patrick started talking about how much more enlivening it often is to watch it than to read about
it. Well, you had the Peter Jackson documentary that came out, They Shall Not Grow Old, which had a significant impact on the way that particularly the young children, particularly in the UK, because it came out during Remembrance Day in the UK, how they consumed and understood their history, because all of a sudden the black and white juttery images of soldiers in the trenches became
personal.
People, real people, colourful people. And I think Netflix, once again, is at the forefront of the way that we are consuming this history. As a bit of a kind of personal and anecdotal view of this, I grew up in Newcastle, and as a young white teenager, I grew up with hip-hop and rap. I was one of the few people in my school that actually enjoyed that. And so I had record collections of you know, Big Daddy Kane, NWA, BDP, all of these kind of Ice-T, all of these formative groups. But I never really understood the history behind it. And I watched a documentary about 2 weeks ago called The Defiant Ones, which traces the, among other things, the rise of Dr. Dre and NWA to the billionaire that he is now. And those kinds of documentary, to my mind, now, of course, they're entertainment, but a lot of history books, if we read an Anthony Beaver book, for example, they are wildly entertaining whilst being obviously historically very, very, very rigorous. So I'm wondering just what the future of history is going to be with the rise of constant audio-visual content.
Yeah.
Because young people, I mean, whether we like it or not, fewer and fewer people are reading books.
I think,
I was going to say, I think as much of that is the decline in a market, I guess, for historical, popular reading history.
I think, Netflix is really, really well placed to not only invest in the tech, harness it to sort of soup up these old images. They can get a narrator, or any publishing house can get a narrator, but they also get the preeminent historians. In the Malcolm X one, they had Zahir Ali, they had the Reverend Al Sharpton, so in the Malcolm X documentary, but in the recent World War II in Colour, they had some Max Hastings, Professor Saul David. They're getting the most preeminent historians in that particular bespoke tailored field.
Yeah.
They're getting them on camera to sort of add analysis to, analysis with real, real provenance.
Yeah.
And not just to documentaries. There's one that quite a few of my friends have talked to me about the Ottomans, the rise of the Ottomans, and its drama interspersed with historians talking about it. So I think you're right. Yeah. I think that's becoming that kind of fusion of those two genres is becoming much more.
So bring together what you were both saying. I mean, it's bringing those academic historians who operate in maybe atomized world of the university, producing papers and research articles, is bringing them into the public domain in a way probably that's never really happened before. Yeah, you might get the odd BBC 4 documentary, but this is actually putting them sort of on a platform to talk to ordinary people like us with an interest in history, or who just happen to be on their couch watching Netflix. It brings them into the public domain in a maybe a way that's never really happened before, in an accessible, entertaining way.
Now, the way we've been talking sounds like we're perhaps sponsored by Netflix.
Love to.
Are there any are there any dangers inherent? Danger, perhaps the wrong word, but the way that the content is being consumed, historical content is being consumed, is there anything we should be wary of? Are we going somewhere where there's just so much information and there's no control over the information? Should there be any control over the historical information that we receive?
I guess the biggest danger I see with this sort of thing is losing the rigour of the discipline. But I guess where Patrick was talking about the inclusion of historians, I guess that's what, in individual series, I guess, act as a check.
As long as they do have history. Because I'll be honest with you, fellas, I've seen some other documentaries on Netflix that I've switched off after 10 minutes because they don't listen, watch, or read well at all. So I think
that's true. Yeah. There's a bonus, I think. Netflix are so big and they've got so much capital, they can afford to do things that might fail. So they can look at bespoke areas of history that typically aren't covered in syllabi anywhere around the world. They can look at it, harness it, jump on it. If it doesn't work, it doesn't really matter to them. Whereas maybe public sector broadcasters or others working on a smaller budget, they can't afford for that to happen. So they go time and time again to maybe the things that we are already more well-versed in, the Nazis, Soviet Union, the Cold War. So Netflix have definitely spun. I mean, there was a It was a very, very violent dramatization of colonial Canada. I think it was called Empire. It was about the Hudson's Bay Company.
Mm. Oh, yeah, it had Tom Hardy in it.
That's the one. That's the one. They can afford to take these really, really niche perspectives. I know Amazon
colonial
have done it
Canada.
That.
I mean, it's good to write books about it, right?
Well, this is really weird.
I don't know.
Pat, this is so weird. Go on. But the reason Colin brings that up is because we did a little thing on a chap called Lord Durham that we published on Amazon a couple of years ago.
Which was a good read, actually.
Yeah, it was a very short read. I had a dream about Lord Durham last night. So weird. I can't remember what the dream was, but he was very short and had a long wig. That's all I can remember.
Wow.
Right, shall we draw this to a close, gentlemen? Because the sun is now quite high in the sky, and I think we've done history on Netflix a bit of justice.
I think so, absolutely.
Okay. Can we share one little thing about a book that we published about
it's
2 weeks
book.
Ago? Versus History published a book. It's called An Infographic History of Germany, 1918 to 1945. In that book, there are 55 infographics that you can download for free when you buy the book, including there's historiography on every other page, there's analysis on every other page, specifically about that period of time segmented into the core topics of study. And it's done very, very well over the last 2 weeks, but I would suggest it's a great thing for home learning, for students and for teachers, or for the average reader of history. It's called An Infographic History of Germany, and it's on Amazon now.
Done, yeah. I like it.
Right. So, it's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me and my roof.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.